Go Strategic is pleased to present the School of Kingdom Citizenship. This lesson is entitled Constitutions and Legal Systems by Dr. Paul Jaley.
Hello, my name is Dr. Paul Jaley, and I am now doing this lesson on constitutions and legal systems. And when we think about constitutions and legal systems throughout history, we need to ask ourselves a question. Is there a legitimate standard for the nations? Is there a legitimate model that nations can look to for models of constitutional law and also legal systems of justice? So as we do, we go beginning with creation. And when we look at the natural law that the Bible talks about in Romans 1:20, that God has written a law into the conscience of mankind. And in Romans 2:12 to 15, we see that that written that law into creation, and then the conscience, there's that natural law, not a law derived from nature, but a law given by God, his moral law, the Ten Commandments and their attributes and their implications and consequences, written that into the nature of mankind. That's critical to understand. When we look at creation, we find out that there is a law that God has made, that he's built into every fabric of creation. And it's for all nations, not just one or two. It's to be the guide for all nations. It is common to all, both people and to rulers. And being common to all, in that sense, it's the law of the land, as Genesis 4 couldn't be referenced for this when Cain killed Abel. It was the blood that cried out from the land. In other words, the law of the land was built into creation, and it was a law against murder. Long before there was any written law, keep in mind that before there was any written law that mankind could follow, there was a law built into creation because God is the creator. And when he creates, he does that in a powerful way that we can see glimpses of continually. And it's interesting to note that when you study ancient civilizations and law systems, all the way back, the closer the ancient civilization is to the time of creation, we find more and more references to natural law, but also a stamp of the creator is still clearly seen in those legal systems. In other words, they borrow from that creation, from that understanding of common grace, we might say, that is upon all human beings. The further we get from creation, the more distant, the more time that sin has to compromise and corrupt a legal system, the less we see that image. Quoting here from Herb Titus, and when he says the following, while the Roman law was a deathbed convert to Christianity, the common law was a cradle Christian. So wrote John C.H. Wu in his 1955 encomium to the Anglo-American legal system known as the common law. Wu, a convert to Christianity in the 1930s and a noted international statesman and jurist and law professor, documented this claim by tracing the history of the English common law from Bracton through Cook to Blackstone. Now, think about this for just a moment. Think about the phrase that Wu uses and documents and says this, while Roman law was a deathbed convert to Christianity. In other words, Roman law ran out of gas. It ran out of its validity. It was no longer, it was continually corrupting from the Roman Republic to the Roman imperial state and the centralization of power. It became a deathbed to Christianity because there was no other place to turn. And yet, we find this, that the common law itself was a cradle Christian from the beginning. See, common law is right from creation, from the beginning. And that's the model that we can go to, and it's articulated and clearly revealed in the scriptures. In fact, it's interesting to recognize that, of course, due to the fall, we can't discern the law of nature as clearly as we once did. Therefore, we're going to need revealed law. We're going to need the Bible itself to give us the ideas so that civilization can progressively decline without the Bible, but it will then can progressively move upward with greater worth to individuals. You see, this is the concept and the principle of transcendence, that God transcends all of creation. God is a transcendent being. He is both transcendent, of course, and he's immanent as well. But the idea is this, that we can come to God and recognize that this transcendent principle, you have to have something to start from. Otherwise, we just do experimental from all throughout history. And we look at the best points of history and don't know why they were good or why they were bad. The second quote I'm looking at here, and I'm continuing with Titus and then moving on to Blackstone. He says, Bracton, 1235 AD, named by Wu as the father of the common law, was a churchman, learned in both canon and Roman law. Bracton laid down an unmistakably Christian philosophy of law. Now listen to what he says. The king himself ought not to be under man, but under God and under the law, because the law makes the king. There is no king where will and not law wields dominion. That as a vicar of God, he, the king, ought to be under the law is clearly shown by the example of Jesus Christ. For although there lay open to God for the salvation of the human race many ways and means, he used not the force of his power, but the counsel of his justice. Thus he was willing to be under the law that he might redeem those who were under the law. Think of this concept now. When God sent Jesus, he could have simply sent Jesus into the world and through miracles and others established his kingdom just directly. He had all the power to do so. He could have upended the Roman Empire that many of the Jews expected to happen. Instead, Jesus came under the law. In other words, he came as a human being. He came incarnating into the flesh of a human being. And because of that, he recognized and was submitted to the law of God. He came according to the law of God. This is critical to recognize. Cook, he goes on to say, in the 1500s, early 1600s, showed incomparable courage when he cited Bracton in his momentous encounter with King James I, who claimed that he personified the law as king. Cook, like Bracton, understood that God, not man, was the ultimate source of law. There's that principle of transcendence again. Even that law that governed the civil realm, Cook had confidently proclaimed that the law of nature was before any judicial or municipal law. The law of nature is that which God, at the time of creation of the nature of man, infused into his heart for his preservation and direction. This is lex aeterna, the moral law, called also the law of nature. And by this law, written with the finger of God in the heart of man, were the people of God a long time governed before the law was written by Moses. Once again, the law is in creation. You do not need a written law or a civil government or a civil official to tell you something is wrong. If you recognize it in your own heart, there's some common grace here that people know. They know certainly that murder is wrong. They know certainly that these are happening. Now, the more corrupt someone gets, the more they reject that natural law, yes, the more dimly reflective it is. And that's why we need another law to enhance it. And this is where we get to Blackstone and his commentaries on the laws of England. And yet these are pervasive. His introduction is worth the entire book. Every individual who wishes to see liberty come in their nation should read Blackstone, especially the introduction. He summarizes the things that we've been saying from the biblical account of creation. And he says this, "This natural law has given manifold occasion for the benign interposition of divine providence, which in compassion to the frailty, the imperfection, and the blindness of human reason, hath been pleased at sundry times and in diverse manners to discover and enforce its laws by an immediate and direct revelation. The doctrines thus delivered we call the revealed or divine law, and they are to be found only in the Holy Scriptures. The revealed law is, humanly speaking, of infinitely more authority than what we generally call the natural law, because one is the law of nature expressly declared to us by God himself. The other is only what, by the assistance of human reason, we imagine that law to be. If we could be as certain of the latter as we are of the former, both would have equal authority. But till then, they can never be put in any competition together. Therefore, as Bracton says, upon these two foundations, the law of nature, that's the law that is imbued by God into creation, natural rights. We call them natural rights, unalienable rights, because not because they're derived from nature, but because God had put them into nature. God is the first cause, the transcendent authority. That law of nature and the law of revelation, that's the Bible, depend all human laws. That is to say, no human laws should be suffered to contradict these. What a powerful statement that Blackstone is saying. Now, he's writing this in the 1750s, and it had a tremendous effect upon those jurists that were in America at the time. But it also had a tremendous effect in England. And dictators and kings didn't like it. But he was basically articulating the fact that this is a standard for all mankind, that every nation can look to these, this standard. And we're beginning with this overall idea that God is the transcendent being. We can't even answer the question, is there a constitution or a legal system that we ought to look to that's a model that's better than any other? We can't even talk about that until we talk about who's transcendent here. Who is the one we should look to for the greatest pervasive sovereign model that we could model our nation after? Now, when we go on and talk about this, we recognize this. Well, then how did God set up government? How did he do it? These jurisdictions are the home, the church, and the state. And derivatives from these are business and ideas of international relations. And these jurisdictions are critical. I want you to just think of it this way, that the individual was first created by God, and therefore the idea of self-government of the individual is the very first sphere of government on earth. But because of sin, human beings no longer govern themselves properly. Well, the next institution that's the safety net for the lack of self-government of the individual is the family. But because due to corruption, parents don't always train their children to control their inner passions and to control themselves by the law of God. So there's a further safety net. It was the priesthood in the Old Testament, the church in the New. And here we have the church that instructs and preaches from the Word of God to convict those families who don't train their children properly and help them to do the proper thing or even instruct them in better ways to train their children. There's another sphere. That's the ecclesia sphere, the ecclesia of the church, the government of the church. That's a model for society and for towns and cities. That's why the churches were named in the New Testament of the Bible according to towns. The church of Thyatira, the church of Laodicea, the church of Ephesus. Because every church was to light their city and be a model of that. Not to enforce it from the top down, but to merely be a model and an example. Civil government, by the time we get to Genesis 9, because the ecclesia is in type in Genesis chapter 8, where Noah offered sacrifice before God like a priest. The key was in the protection of life, liberty, and property, proper justice in Genesis 9 after the flood, when man began to repopulate. And civil government was ordained to be the safety net when things crumble at the other spheres of jurisdiction. But those are separate jurisdictions. Civil government doesn't have all the jurisdictions. This principle of jurisdictions is imperative to understand. We have a world today where most people are looking to government as the ultimate jurisdiction for every problem to be solved. And God did not do that. God empowered other jurisdictions so that individuals would have liberty and government would be limited. In fact, we recognize that this is another one of those 12 master principles that we're emphasizing in this class, and that's limits. Governments are limited. Magistrates are limited. They don't have total power. They're not to have total power. They rule by consent. They rule from the bottom up. This is creation law. This is the way God designed nations to be formed. And the Hebrew Republic, the idea that in the Hebrew Republic we have this time period in Israel, ancient Israel's history, for 400 years, where they were governed basically by self-government. Now, because they refused self-government, we find in the whole book of Judges that every single judge that ruled them in magistrates, the further you got and the more you had individuals, further you got into sin and corruption, the more power they took. So that the illustration of the book of Judges becomes very clear. If the people refuse to govern themselves, then partly by God's mercy, he will give more and more power to civil government that individuals will not go totally anarchistic. Yeah, you and I have to recognize, however, that this is a progression that we see in the Old Testament. We find that God has set forth a standard for all constitutions and legal systems. And when we think of limits, and we think of the limitation of law, I want to go to that next quote. And this is a quote from R.J. Rushdoony in his classic book, Institutes of Biblical Law. And he says this, of the Ten Commandments, eight are stated in negative terms.
A negative concept of law confirms a double benefit. First, it is practical, in that a negative concept of law deals realistically with a particular evil. The law has a modest function. The law is limited, and therefore the state is limited. Second, and directly related to the first point, a negative concept of law ensures liberty, except for the prohibited areas. All of man's life is beyond the law, and the law is of necessity indifferent to it. Now think about this for just a moment. The Bible introduces the legal concept as a masterful principle for all nations, negative law. In other words, let's look at the opposite, positive law. Positive law we call permit law. We call it the fact that unless there's a law that tells you you can do something, you can't. Think of it, if the default of human beings based on the creation of God is you can't do anything unless some other person holding some power gives you permission, you have no liberty. All your rights are government granted. All your rights are permitted by somebody else. But think of the opposite, which is the way God did it in the scriptures, that you have total liberty. Think of the Garden of Eden for just a moment. In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were given the freedom to eat all the trees in the garden except one. That's really limited government. In fact, they had more freedom than they ever had in restrictions. But when they would violate in that small area of restrictions, they lost the rest of their liberty. So you and I must recognize that this concept of negative law is powerful. It means that the only power government has is what's clearly stated in a constitution that's given to the government by consent. So the individual has that power from God. Now, they don't have all power to do anything. They're not in a state of license. They're in a state of liberty under law, God's law, whether it's written or not. They're under that moral law. God will deal with them, whether in this life or the next. Now, that concept of negative law is powerful. It's that application of that one of those principles that we talk about, the master principles of limitations that God has placed on government. It's an express powers constitution, we call it. A constitution that the only thing the power of government has is what's expressed. Now, if you subtly convince a people that they have no liberty unless government gives them permission, well, you're going to have permit law in every area. And this is what the Roman Empire became, an empire of permit law, an empire of permissive law, where the government had to positively give you permission rather than the individual. And there are always government rulers and kings and queens throughout history who have all these reasons why people should not have liberty and they should not be given that freedom of choice. However, God puts it there. Now think of Hammurabi's code and the law of nature. Hammurabi's code was given approximately the time of Abraham. And the amazing thing about Hammurabi, he didn't declare to be knowing God. But here is a law system fairly close to creation and at 2000 BC that has a lot of the law of nature in it. It has a lot of common law concepts. But there are several key things that are missing that are crucial to our discussion that make it distinct from the law of God and the Ten Commandments. Who was, this is John Eidsmo now speaking in his historical and theological origins of law throughout the world. Why, who was this Amraphel of Genesis 14, 1 and 9? Shinar clearly means Babylonia. The only Babylonian king who reigned around the time of Abraham's, 2000 BC, with a name remotely similar to Amraphel was Hammurabi. If Amraphel is in fact a Hebrew form of Hammurabi, note the parallel syllables of Am and Ham and Raph and Rab, then Abraham came into contact and conflict with one of the greatest lawgivers of the ancient world. Notice also that Ur of the Chaldees, out of which Abraham had come, was part of Hammurabi's Babylonia. There was nothing, now he makes this comment, which I think is very interesting, in the study, there is nothing in the code of Hammurabi about the rights of the individual against the state. Now think about this. So you have this pragmatic law, precedent law, statute law, but without the original fundamental laws, which are the Ten Commandments. All the other laws in the Old Testament apply one or more of the Ten Commandments to a specific situation. But the specific application cannot become the precedent or the model for future law systems, or you'll continually have evolutionary law. It's not good. You got to go back to the original fundamental principles. That's what Hammurabi's code was missing. And therefore, there's no way where an individual could say, hey, the civil government's grown too big. It is now taking away my liberty. It's taking away all my freedom of choice. There's another one of those master principles. Taking away that, how can this operate? It can't operate properly. No, it can't. And that's the key thing. In fact, he makes this other statement, Eidsmo does, that Mesopotamian law changed over time, and the changes were not necessarily for the better. Because you see, the further the law system moves away from creation, and nobody's looking back and being held accountable to go back to the beginning, back the way God initially formed it, it's going to go more and more corrupt, as he notes there. This is interesting as well, because when the creation of the Hebrew government, the ancient Israel government that God used as a model, forming a government before they chose a king for 400 years to about 1450 to 1050 BC, during that time period, partially the period of the judges and other areas. And we always emphasize the negative part that mankind, there was no king in Israel, so everybody did what he was right in his own eyes, lost his self-government. But there's another aspect of it. There was the greatest liberty of Israel during those 400 years of any ancient kingdom. The greatest literacy rate, and the greatest form of government, as Deuteronomy says, what other nation has this kind of a classic constitution and law system? What other nation? Because we've gotten it from the revelation of God. We have it from the Word of God. We actually have a standard to go to, and we can look at that standard. The Hebrew Republic, Moses was the one, the president. Exodus 18 tells us this. There was a representative form of the government, an aspect. There were 660,000 representatives based on how Exodus 18 deals with representing a leader over tens. That was to be the neighborhood. Leaders over 50s, the village or the city. Leader over thousands, like a county. The counties of England were called the hundredth because they were rulers over hundreds. Were several towns. It was this a bottom-up, inside-out appeal system of justice where you had representatives representing the views of the people, but also by consent of the governed. They would elect these individuals who were then to make the laws and apply the laws of God. Now, if you study carefully Exodus 18 in Deuteronomy chapter 1, and you look at the Hebrew construction, you find very clearly that whether they voted this way, by stretching the hand toward, as the New Testament word says, or some other way, we find out that there was a house of representatives, so to speak, under Moses. But not just a house of representatives. And put it this way, think of it this way. When it was just Moses, if you just have a monarchy, the failure of that is no one person can take care of every aspect of government. Everybody lined up at Moses' tent door to try to find out everything that was wrong and everything that God wanted to do. Instead, now he had representatives that would take it with him, and only Moses would deal with that, which was an appeal, all the way up to the top. So the judicial system was bottom up by appeal. And then in Numbers chapter 11, we find this interesting thought. Moses is saying, oh my gosh, this is not all going to work. You can't just have a leader, the one, the president, and then have a house of representatives. We need something else that's a buffer in between. Because guess what? When you move toward pure democracy, what did that house of representatives do? It voted in the golden calf. That does not mean that democratic elements in government are evil. Not at all. But what it means is a pure democracy can become mobocracy, as it showed there. You need a balance. In order to have a republic, by definition, going back to the original, you have to have the one, the few, and the many. You need to have a constitution system, yes, that deals with the leader of the nation, but what keeps that leader from becoming a god, becoming a tyrant? It's the limits of the law. It's the limits of that constitutional law. And now you have a House of Representatives. What about the Senate? Well, the Senate, that's the literal Hebrew word for senator, is these are the 70 princes. Or 70 senators, that are 12 of them were leaders of their tribes, and the other were leaders of thousands. So you had 58 leaders of thousands, 12 leaders of the tribe, of each of the tribes, and you have this idea of three forms of government blended into one, a partial monarchy, a partial democracy, and a partial aristocracy. And yet there are jurisdictional separations of powers. Another aspect of the clear
issue of one of those 12 principles that we need to emphasize. You've got to have a separation of powers between various branches of a government, or you're going to have aspects of tyranny that will grow. So the characteristics of the Hebrew Republic, I want to just list these. This is the standard that God gives for a system of government. And think about it also that when you look at these things, you recognize that you can see these things taking place as you look through the nation of Israel and you look through the ideology. Now, I want to refer to you also a chart that you have in there on Daniel's interpretation. What a phenomenal vision and what an interesting heart of this. Here Daniel gives the interpretation before Nebuchadnezzar. And he says, look, you're the head of gold, you're Babylon. But then he goes down the idea from gold into silver and brass and bronze. And then he goes down to the feet of clay. And then he said in his vision that there's going to be a stone cut out without hands. That's a reference to Christ, I believe, in the virgin birth. And then it's going to hit the feet, bottom up, and that kingdom will grow and fill the whole world. It will cause those governments to collapse. See, the ultimate goal, God has, he's going to displace the kingdoms of this world with the kingdoms of his son. Therefore, you see this contrast between this. In fact, if you have a nation that has a top-down, centralized government that doesn't allow liberty of choice and doesn't recognize that God is the one that gave liberty in the human being, and the government is the servant of the people, they do not have automatic power from God, and then they grant some liberty to the people. If you have that, then you recognize the dominant religious philosophy in that nation is not Christianity. It's not the best system of constitutional laws and legal systems that you could have. And then it takes a whole paradigm shift to begin to work in the opposite direction. And we look at these characteristics. Now, first of all, in the, and I'm going to look here at E.C. Wines, and this is a writer of the Commentaries on the Ancient Laws of the Hebrews in the Old Testament, a phenomenal book, printed in the 1880s. And a pastor who is feeling that he wrote this book thinking, hey, America's lost its own roots, and we were not patterned after Greece or Rome. We were patterned after Jerusalem and Hebrews and the Hebrew people. He said this, "It is probable that the Hebrew people enjoyed as great a degree of personal liberty as can ever be combined with an efficient and stable government. I lay down the following proposition broadly and without qualification. The members of the body politic called into being by the Constitution of Moses stood upon a more exact level and enjoyed a more perfect community of political rights, dignities, and influence than any other people known in history, whether ancient or modern times." Wow, what a statement. And yet when you read his book, what a scholar. He's really done his homework. He's demonstrated some powerful concepts here. Political equality. What ancient nation ever thought of such a thing? Political equality, that's an idea from God. And that's one of the 12 master principles. We're equal before God. We're not equal in external things or external personalities or external gifts. We're equal because we're all creations of God. No matter what race, no matter what gender, whoever we are equal before God because he is our creator. This was clearly laid in the Hebrew Republic. It's clearly a proposition, a premise, a root idea that needs to be pursued. It's also, there's another characteristic of the Hebrew Republic, and that is rule by consent. Or in other words, they had an elective magistrate in the Hebrew Republic. They had choice, another one of those key principles that we often refer to. The people had a choice on who to vote for the best character in their neighborhood, and then in their village, and then in their county, and then in their nation. They recognize this. But another aspect was separation of powers, as we've mentioned. The separation between executive, legislative, and judicial. Isaiah 33:22 tells us this, the Lord is our king, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our judge. The Lord is all three, but he's the only one that's all three. No human institution and civil government can you have one person be all three categories, or they're becoming like God. They are fighting for the throne, so to speak, as a tyrant. So Isaiah 33 makes this clear. It defines those three areas of justice, and yet those aspects need to be separate. Just as horizontally they need to be separate,
like we've said, in the House of Representatives or a Senate type of government. Now think of this. There's a bottom-up appeal system also in the Hebrew Republic. It's called localism. This is the idea that you would solve problems at a local place first. And only if you're having a problem, you ask for wisdom from someone who's got a broader perspective and has had more experience than you had. See, justice is best done locally among those individuals. If it's done from a great distance, the more the distance of the government is from the individual with the problem had, the more corruption you're going to have. That idea of localism is paramount, and it is clearly articulated in the Hebrew Republic of the Old Testament as a standard from God. Now, here's another one that is very, very important. And it's often not seen to be for the powerhouse that it is. And that's the common law jury. A jury of one's peers is really that principle of reciprocity. What does reciprocity mean? It's the crux of justice. It's the meaning that we get our due. We get the punishment that fits the crime. It's redemptive. It rehabilitates us. It restores us back to the community. We can be forgiven because it requires some measure of repentance. You can't, by law, change someone's heart. But if someone steals something and they have to personally give it back with interest, as the justice system has built on that principle of restitution, that idea of reciprocity is the true engine of real justice. And the common law jury is something derived from Scripture that gives us this idea. Now, I have given a 2-page sheet on the common law jury. Now, I'm going to go through this because it is so imperative to understand. First of all, the origins of the common law jury. The Bible says in Deuteronomy 17, whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of only one witness. Proverbs 11:14 says, where there is no counsel, the people fall. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. And in the article that I'm going to look at, in both dealing with Blackstone's commentaries and the article by Herb Titus, a constitutional attorney, deriving it from biblical law. He said this, Blackstone said, some authors have endeavored to trace the original of juries up as high as the Britons themselves, the first inhabitants of our land. But certain it is that they were in use among the earliest Saxon colonies. Now, this goes back to King Alfred, but it goes back much further than that. It goes back to the Bible itself. Because the Bible said, in the multitude of counselors, there's wisdom. It shouldn't just be one judge that makes a decision. It should be one of your peers. And let's examine this to see how biblical this is. And this, I believe, is just as, see, people have said throughout history, the common law jury is the palladium of justice. In other words, the key cornerstone. Because it's the most local place where you can truly get reciprocity. It's sacred. In other words, the definitions of it. Blackstone, as Herb Titus says, Blackstone defined the trial by jury to require the unanimous decision of 12 of his equals and neighbors, indifferently chosen, superior to all suspicion. This palladium, Blackstone wrote, must remain sacred and inviolate, lest the liberties of the people be lost. Let's take this definition and look and analyze it. First of all, it's sacred. In other words, it comes from God, comes from the principles of the Word of God. Second, it's a palladium, effectual defense of justice at the local level. Now, the jury has 12 participants. Now, in this handout, I document this because I think it's imperative to understand how important this is. So universal, Herb Titus writes, was the number of 12 that the trial by jury of 12 men was called at common law the trial per pai, or by the country. The system of trial by jury, composed of 12 persons representative of the community, was rooted in the very history of the civil polity of nations. And nowhere is the evidence more explicitly found than the civil polity of the Old Testament Israel. Under her civil covenant, the people retained certain rights to rule themselves, and in particular to pass judgment on certain causes. In Numbers 35, there is the detailed distinction between murder and manslaughter and the explicit command that the congregation shall judge. And as E.C. Wines, that author again, has written, the congregation referred to the people of Israel. How do they act in their judicial capacity? Undoubtedly through their representatives, for that is how they acted in their legislative and executive capacities. Being composed of 12 tribes, what would be more representative of the congregation than a body of 12 men? See, this number 12 is a biblical number that is derived here. But the jury is not just of 12, but it is a unanimous jury. Why? Why unanimity on a jury? These are the crucial principles of justice. In Exodus 19, Moses brought the civil covenant between God and the nation of Israel to the elders of the people. The elders in turn, and as representatives of the people, consented to the covenant, and their consent was unanimous, Exodus 19, 7 and 8. Unanimity, then, is essential because a vote short of consensus would be illegitimate. One's life, liberty, and property could not be denied unless one's own peers concluded without dissent they should be forfeited. Think about this. The deck is stacked to the innocence of the individual being charged with the crime. If you have to get a unanimous verdict, only one person who has a reasonable doubt as to whether that person was guilty. See, the premise biblically is so much bottom up with this liberty in the creation of the people that it is simply given in this way, that it is very clear from Scripture that it is better to have a guilty person go free than an innocent person charged improperly. The deck is stacked against the one being guilty till proven innocent. This is a key crux to judicial system. The jury is also composed of neighbors. Titus goes on to say, a jury, to be a jury, must be composed of one's neighbors, either the neighbors of the plaintiff or victim, or the neighbors of the defendant, or both. The purpose of this requirement is clearly accountability. This personalization of the judicial process has its roots in the Bible. Moses had created a judicial structure diffusing jurisdiction among the rulers of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Justice in the smallest matters were to be handled in the most neighborly of courts. Think about that. And the larger matters, the more magisterial, jurors would therefore be drawn accordingly. You see, a neighbor knows you. A neighbor knows all about you. And they know your reputation. They know your character. It's better to have people that know you and are neighbors to you. You'll get greater justice in that regard. But the jury is also to be knowledgeable. At common law, prospective jurors were expected to know something about a case before they were chosen to sit in judgment. Because they were neighbors of either the plaintiff or victim or defendant or both, they would know something of the character of the parties. Since the event took place in the vicinity, they would also likely know something about the facts relevant to the case. Neither knowledge of a jury's character, reputation, or family, nor knowledge of the event disqualified a potential juror. But evidence of particularly or of bias did. Such evidence, however, was not presumed, but was to be uncovered through questions put to the prospective juror before he could be seated. So the idea is you wanted to be knowledgeable about the case. You want them to be knowledgeable about the individuals, but not biased. Not simply saying, well, because I don't like the person, I'm automatically going to rule against him or any of those kinds of things. This was where justice was at its crux in a nation. A jury also makes its ruling on both facts and the law. Again, quoting this, because the jury normally returned a general verdict, it became commonplace to say that the jury was the judge as to both law and fact. This statement, however, has been hotly contested over the years. And this did not mean that the jury could decide without regard to the law, but only that it was not bound by the court's opinion of what the law was. This understanding of the role of the jury is also rooted in the Scriptures. In both instances where the congregation has authority to decide an individual case, the law that governs the decision is not the opinion of a judge, but the true law of the case. What if the judge is corrupt? What if the judge is not looking at the law properly? What if the law gives more power than it should to the ruler? The people need to look to the original and go by that. All of this is consistent with the Blackstonian doctrine that the opinion of a judge is not law, but only the evidence of law, although evidence deserving of great respect and attention. So you see, here are very critical aspects of a common law jury derived from the Scriptures than at the Palladium of Justice. And the significance of reciprocity is clear here. I want you to think about this. The common law jury has the ultimate good goal of true justice with no respect of persons, where all play by the same rules. The average citizen will desire to make sure that the victim is satisfied by the law or restitution, where the punishment fits the crime, as exhorted in Deuteronomy. Your eye shall not pity. Life be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. The idea of reciprocity is very, very clear here. And the idea, it becomes even more critical. For instance, there is, as Jesus instructed in Matthew 5, this must not be done with an attitude of revenge, making a small matter larger when it was merely an offense. You have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your cheek, turn the other to him also. No, Jesus did not abrogate the punishment fitting the crime. He did not abrogate foot for foot, eye for eye. What he abrogated in this very clearly was an idea of getting even. Vengeance is for God alone and not for us. And this is where, if you have a common law jury system in a nation, it requires maturity of the average individual who knows the law and knows something about justice. There's a common sense meaning of justice when that's the case. And yet I'm sure you are aware of the fact that where jury system is still practiced in the earth and among nations, now there are some judges that say you can't know anything about the case and you can't have ever heard of anyone in the case, and they just dilute the power of the jury itself. There's no greater self-defense of or self-government and liberty than the common law jury. It inspires the average citizen to know the law and how it should be applied. It produces a bond among neighbors when deliberating, together seeking unanimity. By having 12 individuals have such intense discussion requiring a unanimous verdict, it protects the premise that you're innocent till proven guilty. Consider this. Where might you find, other than a common law jury, the fact that individual citizens can rule in favor of someone's innocence based on the facts, and even at times judging the law, whether it's legitimate, where one of the parties is the government itself? I could point in my own nation to several major cases where the jury overrode one of the parties and it was the government itself. What nation? Where do you get that? That's a little reflection of Hebrew law, and it's powerful. The common law jury, as an illustration of the principle of reciprocity, strengthens the bonds of community and the sense of mutual concern valued as a concept in decision-making. So you and I need to recognize that this is a powerful concept, the common law jury. Now, I want to cover just a few more points before we close. And this may be a mouthful. This may be a lot to take in. But I can tell you this. You can study. You can take a look at the notes. You can take a look at the outlines. You can take a look at the sources, the bibliography, and do greater study and how it might be applied to your own nation. Now, the Hebrew justice system, there's another handout for that, and this is just a quick overview of this. This justice system is the first table of the law, the Old Testament, is your walk with God. Second table, how you deal with humanity. The statute laws, the case laws, I can list some examples of how case laws in Exodus reflected one of the Ten Commandments and its application. This is the idea that there was a difference between fundamental law and statute law in the Hebrew justice system in the Old Testament before the nation chose a king. Those principles were still there after they chose the king, but they began to corrupt at a greater rate than previously. You recognize that the idea of this application of the law is so important because you have law and you have equity. Equity is the mercy of God that you get some measure of what you deserve. Not fully what you deserve, because none of us deserve a good thing based on our own nature and most of our thoughts at times when we deal with that. And yet we're made in the image of God. So we're marred by sin, but still made in the image of God. So there is this tipping in the scales of justice to be innocent till proven guilty. And yet we recognize that it's the application of law to specific cases that becomes so important, like that common law jury. There are qualifications given in the Bible for those to hold civil office. Good character above reproach, as I write on the sheet. Proven wisdom in applying principles of justice. unwilling to take a bribe. One key question to ask somebody who is running for office in your nation: have you ever taken a bribe? Has someone ever been able to buy your vote? Whether it's some activist group or some large gift, are you beholden to that person? Or have you ever rejected that gift? Very important question. You're obedient to the laws, and you don't have an insurrection spirit. So how much do you obey the very laws that you purport to follow? See, we have in nations this corrupt idea that I'm going to vote for a law and want that law to be enforced as long as it's not enforced in my district, as long as it's not enforced for me, as long as I don't have to follow it, someone else can. That disqualifies someone in an idealistic sense from being a magistrate. You're unwilling to conduct an investigation to make a just decision. Have you studied both sides? Do you study both sides of a situation in order to come to a conclusion? Or is your mind already made up in the beginning? Are you personally just? Do you rule in the fear of God? The Bible does not say that an individual must be a Christian. Nations can choose that, and they have, but it's dealing with the fear of God. Do you have an understanding that there's an eternal right and wrong that you'll be held accountable to? And one who keeps his word and is consistent in his actions. Very, very critical for civil qualifications for magistrates. And due process. Justice is the ultimate goal. No respecter of persons. All by the same rules. Should be two or three independent witnesses prior to a conviction. The victim must be satisfied by the laws of restitution. And the forms of punishment include, in the Bible, they've included death, capital punishment, banishment, confiscation, imprisonment, slavery, all depending on this. Slavery, not in the sense of being owned by another individual, but in the sense of losing your liberty because of committing crimes. And the punishment must fit the crime by laws of restitution. See, these concepts of justice are in the Bible, and they're in the Old Testament primarily, but they're affirmed by the New Testament. And they become a standard for justice before the earth, and justice in all those things that we have been talking about. First table of the law is religious liberty. Second, civil liberty. Now let's go on and just compare the following. Often today we say that the highest forms of government were the Greeks and the Romans. And the interesting part about that is the Greek systems of government were very interesting. They reacted to centralized tyranny of the ancient world. And when they did that, they moved toward democracy, it is true. And you see some of these rulers, whether it's Solon, the Greek lawgiver, who possibly had interviews with Daniel in Babylon since he visited there and could have come away with some ideas. Wow, we're not giving enough power to the people here. And the ideas of the Greeks doing this, they're borrowing from other law systems, and particularly the Jews. And Cleisthenes, when he spread power among various interest groups, you can see there in the outline, the city-state, the popular assembly, the ecclesia, the council of 500, chief officers chosen annually by lot, court systems having six judges. After your term was over, you had to give account for your actions. Selection, when done, was by lot and not by vote. But in order to curb tyranny, an ostracism could take place. 6,000 citizens could impeach, could remove somebody. All these things are improvements, but it's a cluttering and a moving toward and away from tyranny, but it's not going back to a solid foundation. Philosophers, whether it's Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, all had some aspect of natural law and revelation in their teachings. Thus, we can learn from them. They become very good lessons for us. But again, it's not going back to the original. And therefore, the Greeks could not be they had no more than 10% of their population that was ever free anyway. And so the idea of them being the originator of pure democracy is a bit off, though they did have some tendencies to try to reduce power. What about the Romans? They reacted to the dangers of democracy. They saw the fact that you would have individuals that were not informed. And they moved from their Roman Republic, where they had a better borrowing from the Hebrews, and then they began to be more corrupted when they became an empire. And you recognize this. They had classes and their families and citizens, 10%. Their Roman virtues were good. Social, humor, mercy, dignity, tenacity, frugality, gravity, respect, etc. Borrowed from God and His Word. In fact, look at quote number 7 here. We can see this and recognize this. Now, one of the things we looked at in quote number 6, we mentioned the fact that not every law in the Old Testament is applicable to nations today. Some were just for the Jews. As Westminster Confession of Faith says, to them, ancient Israel, also as a body politic, he gave sundry judicial laws which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging under any now further than the general equity thereof may require. Or the idea is the moral law is applicable, the Ten Commandments, the statute laws are all wisdom, but we have to be careful that laws that were only for Israel, and that's somewhat debated, but the idea is you don't just copy indiscriminately laws out of the Bible without thinking, without exegesis or study, and apply them in the modern sense. But this is the standard for both the structure of government, the pattern of due process, and the pattern of jurisdiction. Now, in number 7, the quote, Cicero in Eismo's book said this, "True law is right reason in agreement with nature. It is of universal application, unchanging and everlasting. There will not be different laws of Rome and at Athens, or different laws now and in the future, but one eternal, unchangeable law that will be valid for all nations, all times, and there will be one master and ruler, God, over us all. For he is the author of this law. He's the promulgator and its enforcing judge. Whoever is disobedient is fleeing from himself and denying the human nature. And by reason of this very fact, he will suffer the worst penalties." So here Cicero articulates the natural law. He articulates the fact that God created us and put in our nature these common law principles. And yet, Cicero did not take you back to the Bible, to the Old Testament law, to a written revelation and source. Thus, though it was great in his time, it became less and less visible because that solid rock foundation has to be there if it's going to be preserved multi-generationally. And here we conclude with this idea that Israel should have an example to other nations. In 2 Chronicles 17, it tells us that the fear of the Lord fell on all the kingdoms around Israel when Israel did follow its own laws. They sent out Levites and taught all the people the laws. They defended their borders. They sought the Lord. They were honored by their enemies. He sent teachers to teach the law of God throughout the kingdom. This is a good example, a peak in Israel's history. Daniel in Babylon influences several kingdoms. And we've seen this with the chart that we talked about. But look at quote number 8 in Rajay Rushdoony's World History Notes. Notice that the influence of Daniel brought to the other nations a powerful example. Whatever abuses of power existed in Persia, as Rushdoony writes, its basic position was this. Unlike Babylon, where the law was subject to the king, in Medo-Persia, the king was subject to the law. In their sense of the authority and supremacy of the law, the Medo-Persian Empire far surpassed the Babylonians, the Greeks, and others. Esther 1:9-8:8 record the power of this law. This inviolability of law is cited with respect to Darius the Mede in Daniel. There's an influence here implied with Daniel working with Cyrus and whatnot in Persia. And here Persia draws it. Well, what do we say? If there are other nations that have the law of God, or parts of the law of God, and the common law, by God's mercy, if any nation imitates the standard of God, even though they don't even recognize God, they're going to benefit from it. From God's mercy, you're going to benefit from every fragment of biblical truth that you apply in your nation. You will benefit from that. And yet, full benefits are better than just partial benefits. To go back and to begin training a new generation in understanding this. And I want to conclude with E.C. Wines here when he realizes this, because yes, Christianity brought forth the law of nations, the idea that nations can get along like extensions of individuals. International relations and the principles of international relations was truly researched out of the Reformation and became encyclopedia applications of biblical ideas on how the nations should get along. No hierarchy above the nations. No nations, nations do not form and just submit to some international organization, but the nations are ruled from the inside out and the bottom up, and they get along like individuals do. It's powerful. And yet I want to conclude with this quote. When we see glimpses in Greece and Rome and other nations today and in ancient history that seem to have good conduct or good ideas, where do they come from? If they just come out of thin air, that's one thing, but I think you'll recognize that as E.C. Wines says, this is what he writes. Clemens Alexandria styles Plato the Hebrew philosopher, and again asserts that the Greeks stole their chief opinions out of the books of Moses and the prophets. About the time of the Babylonian captivity of the Jews, 606 to 536, Greece began to emerge from the depths of ignorance and rudeness in which her people had hitherto been sunk. A spirit of inquiry and research was awakened. A host of Grecian philosophers and historians traveled into Egypt, Chaldea, Babylonia, Phoenicia, and some of them residing in those countries for a long series of years. Grotius says, "Who may not believe that, seeing the law of Moses had such an express image of the divine will, the nations did well in taking their laws thence, that Plato's ideal republic was, in many of its principles, derived from the Hebrew constitution, is an opinion held by many, and as would see, on good grounds." So we recognize this, that in conclusion, I'd say some of the following. First, there is a model that can be trusted for constitutions and legal systems. And it's the model of the Hebrews in the Bible, affirmed in the New Testament by Jesus Christ, who came under the law and submitted to God's law, didn't come outside of it. Second, you can then study this Hebrew Republic. There are great sources that still abound. And as you study it and look at those ingredients, you begin to progressively, incrementally begin to bring some of these things, whatever nation you're in, and you bring them to pass at the local level. You begin with justice in the bottom up. You begin with a standard of justice. And as we see this happen through the church, its example, and individuals building relationships in the culture, when we see these things happen, these particular principles can begin to be implemented at any level, and right at the local level, and begin to be demonstrated as an example. And then we can see, little by little, progressively, only God knows how much time it will take, but the idea from even generations, the kingdoms of this world can look more and more like the kingdom of God and His Christ when we implement the proper models for constitutions and legal systems of justice. God bless you in the pursuit of such an endeavor in the love of Christ and in serving others. Amen.
This is a copyrighted program of Go Strategic, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Go Strategic is an international nonprofit organization that educates and equips leaders and others for effective service and leadership using biblical principles. For more information, visit us online at www.gostrategic.org.